I don't either. Okay, we're going to call together, call to order the, excuse me, the Climate Protection Committee meeting. And roll call, please.
On the roll for the Climate Protection Committee meeting of November 16th, 2017, Director Abe Koga, Director Joya, Director Haggerty, Director Hudson,
here.
Director Rice,
here.
Director Ross, Director Wagon Connect, Committee Vice Chair Sinks,
here.
Committee Chair Barrett,
here.
We are one short of a quorum.
Okay, thank you very much.
You got to take into effect the quality of the four that are here.
And can we say the Pledge of Allegiance? Okay, do we have any public comment on non-agendized items?
I do have three cards. May I call their names?
Absolutely.
Okay. So Amanda Leonis, Janet Stromberg, and Jed Holtzman.
Hi there. My name is Amanda Leonis, and I am representing the City of San Jose today, the Environmental Services Department, Sustainability and Compliance Division, and I'm here today to inform the committee about the development of our city's low-carbon plan. A multi-department effort with selected consultant PwC through extensive technical and community outreach. This plan will focus on reducing greenhouse gas emissions related to energy, mobility, and ensuring a sustainable water supply, and outlines a long-term strategy and a three-year city action plan. This plan will be in compliance under AB 32 and SB 32, but will go further by complying with the Paris Agreement. We hope, as the 10th largest city in the United States and the largest in the Bay Area region, that this plan will foster our city as the leader and model for other cities to develop that pathway. I'm here today to request that the District Climate Protection Committee allow our Environmental Services Department Director, Carrie Romanow, to present to this committee in February. We consider this district a key stakeholder, and we want to just introduce you to the plan and encourage engagement and support in the plan's development and implementation. Please note that we have sent an electric and hard copy formal request to the district. We look forward to hearing more today about the Clean Air Plan and how that relates to our city's low carbon plan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, members of the Climate Protection Committee. Janet Stromberg, 350 Bay Area. One quick comment about attendance at the committee. This is sadly reminding me of the situation that we had about 5 years ago or so, when a year and a half passed before there was a quorum to pass to approve minutes. So I do hope that this is just a rain or maybe exhaustion from yesterday or something, but it's an important committee and we appreciate that you have it and that you consider the things you do. Another short update is just to let you know that we had a meeting with Rural Development and Climate Protection staff to talk about the methane strategy. And it was very productive, and we're quite pleased with the direction things are going and the effort staff is making to get community input on the important rules coming up before you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barrett and directors. Just kind of a brief follow-up on that. Jed Holtzman from 350 Bay Area, thank you all for being here. Before previous Chair Avalos of the Climate Protection Committee came on and kind of re-upped and reconstituted the action of the committee, as Janet said, it had been somewhat moribund. We think that this committee is really critical because a lot of the work that the Air District is doing, planning and rulemaking on greenhouse gases, a lot of which is kind of first in the nation work, and a lot of work that's going to take a lot of buy-in from the board, both in terms of rulemaking and in terms of partnering with, you know, a broad swath of agencies and organizations kind of outside of the normal comfort zone of the Air District, as the Clean Air Plan calls for. because we need that buy-in and because this work is so important to the Air District meeting its mission, and a lot of that is going to be brought here, we would like this committee to be a really vibrant and functioning one. I know that there were some folks who wanted to be on this committee who couldn't get on before it was full, and I guess one thing that I would suggest, I know when I started being a stakeholder here in, I want to say, 2013, Director Zane at that point was participating by video link fairly commonly, and I know that, you know, I have sympathy. I live in San Francisco. It's still kind of a pain to get here on a rainy day. I have sympathy for folks who are coming very long distances for consecutive meetings. So I'm not sure if there's a way, you know, of course we would like folks here in person, but if there was a way to increase participation by allowing, you know, some telecommuting, like we would like our employers in the region to allow. Just an idea for trying to increase participation, and thanks very much.
Is that it, Marcy? Thank you. I just want to ask staff, we still have the option for off-site meetings, don't we?
Yes, we do. We can do that. We have, I think, two locations that we have scheduled in the past, and they're configured for us to work with. So, yeah, that is available.
One's in Sonoma, and yeah. Do we know where the second one is?
San Jose area. The board itself has sort of set up some protocols for when that's possible, when it's not possible. If you'd like to revisit that or be refreshed on that, I think that's something that we could bring to executive committee.
Well, I do remember that there was some issue about it in the old building, and that those were going to be taken care of when we were here. Where is that available, that information?
I believe the two locations. Is that what you're asking
about?
No,
where's the information about when you can have an off-site participation or not?
I think it was something that the executive committee discussed and then referred to the board. I don't remember exactly when that was. So,
yeah, I don't remember that happening after we've moved here, that doesn't mean it didn't.
Yeah. It was a board policy discussion, and I can't also recall whether it was before or after we moved, but it had to do with what types of items were on the agenda and that sort of thing. So.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Okay. So on to the approval. Well, we can't approve the minutes because we don't have a quorum, which was already pointed out. This is item number 4, AB 398, and the Air District Clean Air Plan.
Yes. Good morning, Chair Barrett and members of the Climate Protection Committee. The board has asked staff questions about what is the effect of AB 398 on our clean air plan. The stakeholders have asked questions about that. So this morning, Abby Young, our climate protection manager, will go over the information that's been requested, but also, to me, more importantly, what we will still continue to do. And there's still a lot that we will be able to do as an agency to make a difference in the climate world. Abby.
Thank you, Jean, and good morning, Chair Barrett and members of the committee. First, I'd like to quickly remind us of the overall goals and objectives of the Clean Air Plan that the board adopted last April. As a multi-pollutant plan, we have long-term goals for reducing criteria air pollutants, local toxic air contaminants, and greenhouse gas emissions, as well as achieving equity in the exposure to health risk and allowing citizens of the Bay Area, no matter where they live, to access clean air every day. And our objectives that support achieving those goals focus on reducing emissions from all of those pollutant categories from all sources, focusing in the near term on what we call the super greenhouse gases. These are also referred to as short-lived climate pollutants or high global warming pollutant gases. These are the greenhouse gases that are most powerful in their impact on global warming, so like methane, black carbon, fluorinated gases, etc. What we want to do is really focus on reducing those in the near term while at the same time developing and implementing the strategies that are going to be reducing fossil fuel combustion, which will have those long-term impacts. But what this presentation is really focusing on is legislation recently passed by the state legislature, AB 398, and what it does and how it impacts our Clean Air Plan and the Air District's ability to fully implement the Clean Air Plan. So that's what this presentation is focusing on. So AB 398, which was passed this past summer, reauthorizes the statewide cap-and-trade program through the year 2030. And this is very important because, it provides clear legal authority for the cap-and-trade program, but it also removes uncertainty about the long-range viability of the program. And that helps give a clear market signal to and provides long-term clarity for the businesses and the sectors that are subject to cap and trade. So reauthorization and extension of the cap and trade program is a very good thing. But AB 398 also establishes cap and trade as the mechanism for reducing carbon dioxide emissions from large stationary sources. And as such, it excludes local air districts from adopting or implementing rules to control carbon dioxide from the sources that are subject to the cap and trade program. Now, I'm going to dig a little deeper into that in the next couple of slides, but I just also wanted to mention that there is a lot more in AB 398. There are provisions that try to strengthen the amount of emissions that are reduced within California and requirements on the offsets that can be used and how they 50% of them must provide associated air quality and water quality benefits within the state. There's a lot to the bill, but the main thing is the reauthorization of cap and trade and the limitation to air district authorities. So drilling down into what this means in the Bay Area, what are the stationary sources in the Bay Area that are affected by AB 398? So the cap and trade program applies to large stationary sources in certain industries. And in the Bay Area, this includes our refineries, cement plants, power plants, PG&E as both a power plant owner as well as our natural gas supplier, and also other just very large combustion sources such as hydrogen facilities or metal, steel and iron works, these types of facilities. So in the Bay Area, if you think about carbon dioxide and our regulated sources, the carbon dioxide from all sources that we regulate within the Bay Area, about 95% of that carbon dioxide would fall under these large sources and would be covered by the cap and trade program. So what that means is that our regulatory authority for CO2 would now be precluded for 95% of the CO2 from regulated sources in the Bay Area. That leaves us about 5% of the entities that we regulate, 5% of the, of the CO2 from the facilities that we regulate would still be on the table for us to continue to regulate. And I'll provide a little more detail on that as we go. So now when we talk about our Clean Air Plan and specifically the control strategy and what this legislation does to our ability to implement it, I just wanted to remind folks we have about 85 control measures in the Clean Air Plan that span 9 different economic sectors. Of those 85 control measures, 40 are regulatory measures that address stationary sources. So out of all of those, there are 5 specific control measures that would be affected by AB 398. And I'm just going to briefly talk about those. The Air District is precluded from implementing control measure SS11, or we know this as Rule 1216, which would have controlled carbon dioxide emissions from refineries through emission caps. This does not affect the emission reductions that we anticipated in the plan, because we had not anticipated actual reductions in CO2 emissions from this measure. So this would not affect the emission reductions that we thought we would get out of the plan. The Air District is also precluded from implementing control measure SS12, which was Rule 13.1, where we were thinking of about carbon intensity limits for refineries. This, again, we would be precluded from pursuing. And also, staff had not included estimates for greenhouse gas reductions in the plan from this measure, because it wasn't clear that whether we would get actual reductions or what the scale of those might be. Now, control measure SS17 would lower the threshold at which facilities subject to the Air District's New Source Review Permit Program would have to implement best available control technologies to control greenhouse gas emissions. And the Air District, due to AB 398, is precluded from implementing this control measure for CO2, but it would not be precluded from implementing this measure for other greenhouse gases like methane. SS18, the idea behind the basin-wide combustion strategy was to establish carbon intensity limits on combustion sources as a way to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, as well as criteria air pollutants and toxic air contaminants, through source-by-source rulemaking. So the Air District can still pursue this, but it couldn't do it using CO2 as the main driver for the rule. So staff is now looking at, how might we pursue this strategy, and might there be carbon dioxide reductions that we could achieve as co-benefits of focusing this strategy more on criteria pollutants. So we're still exploring, how we might pursue that measure. And then finally, we had our Portland cement measure SS19 that looked at reducing criteria pollutants from the production of cement, and it also mentioned that we might explore amendments to specifically target CO2 in this measure. We would no longer be able to pursue those kinds of amendments. So this is how AB 398 would specifically address control measures in the Clean Air Plan. But I think it's important to note that these emissions from these measures will not go uncontrolled. So what AB 398 does is it transfers the ability to reduce these emissions away from local air districts and to the cap and trade program. So, whether we're the ones facilitating the emission reductions or ARB is, the intent and the anticipation is that we will still see these emission reductions occur.
Abby, we have a question here. Do you want us to hold those until you're done?
Or no, please okay. Go ahead.
So if we just go back to your last slide, I have two questions. One is, I get that refineries and cement plants are cap and trade parties, so we don't get to regulate their CO2, but as I recall, there are about, 30%? Of our CO2 emissions are coming from other non-CNT stationary sources or not?
Well, there's of carbon so AB 398 only addresses carbon dioxide. And if we're talking about carbon dioxide, 95% of the carbon dioxide from stationary sources in the air
is coming from CNT.
Comes from CNT.
Regulated entities.
But but that doesn't include methane.
Right.
Or nitrous oxide.
Short term.
Black carbon, right.
Okay. So my second question is, while we might not have control, we still have every interest in understanding where all the CO2 equivalents are being generated. Mm-hmm. Do we have any estimate of the efficacy of the state's cap and trade program as it relates to the CNT entities in the Bay Area? So, okay, refinery, cement plant. Maybe it's really complicated because it's a market, but I would hope that the state's program actually would be effective in doing its part to limit greenhouse gas emissions as it applies to the Bay Area. And I see your next slide actually goes to the overall graph.
Well, yeah, so we'll see if that might help answer your question.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So you've seen this chart before, and this is the same version. We haven't changed it since the last time you've seen it. And what this does is it looks at projected trends in greenhouse gas emissions in the different economic sectors out to 2050. And then it's overlaid with the state's different and the air districts' greenhouse gas reduction goals. And the blue layer, the second from the bottom layer, is where AB 398 has an impact. That's the stationary source sector. Now, we don't know yet how AB 398 will affect the emissions in this sector. Now, theoretically, because it is going to impose declining caps on industry, we would theoretically see a reduction in that sector. There are other dynamics at play that are causing movements in emissions in different directions. And so there are many things that we have to track and we have to consider as we continue to hone this strip chart and think about the different uncertainties and reduce the uncertainties. So this is something that we're continuing to work on. We anticipate that emission reductions from cap and trade would help reduce the emissions in that layer. And then we just have to see what the net effect is given other dynamics that are occurring. So up until now, I've talked about how AB 398 limits our authority and where those limitations occur. Now I'm sort of pivoting, and we're going to talk about what's left on the table. So as we were just clarifying, AB 398 does not limit the air district's ability to regulate carbon dioxide from non-cap-and-trade sources, that residual 5% that we were just talking about. So what are those sources? This is small equipment that we regulate. It's small boilers, diesel backup engines, small turbines, ovens and kilns and dryers, incinerators, furnaces, this kind of equipment. That's still on the table for us to continue regulating. It also does not preclude the Air District from regulating methane, nitrous oxide, black carbon, fluorinated gases, non-CO2 greenhouse gases from all stationary sources, even those that are affected by cap and trade. So we still have a large and vibrant rulemaking regulatory program that we can use to limit greenhouse gas emissions in the Bay Area. We still have an enormous grant and incentives program. We have our robust work with local governments. We have an active program addressing land use and transportation emissions. And we have research, education, and community engagement programs which support all of those efforts. And so I'm going to talk a bit about those moving forward. Now, you've seen versions of this table before. This is our rulemaking schedule, and for today's purposes, we're just looking at the very near term through the end of 2018. And you can see we've indicated that a couple of these, SS11 and SS12, I didn't bring my glasses, I think it's SS12, are on indefinite hold as a result of AB 398. Mm-hmm. But I, of course, have to call out the first line on this, the first row on this table. There was a big win yesterday where the board adopted 1118 unanimously. So we're clearly moving forward with this schedule, and there's a lot of work that's going on throughout all these rulemaking efforts. In 2018, we're anticipating giving out around $60 million that will be directly influencing greenhouse gas and other emissions in the Bay Area. We're focusing a lot of this where the Bay Area has the largest portion of greenhouse gases in the transportation sector. And we're using our transportation monies to really affect all manner of vehicles and sources of transportation emissions. Passenger vehicles, heavy-duty vehicles, goods movement, trip reduction, active transportation. We're investing in all of these kinds of strategies. We're also investing in implementing local climate action plans, decarbonizing buildings, new innovative strategies, implementing technologies through our technology implementation office, and continuing to protect public health through our wood smoke program. So a very active funding and financing program. Now, we've talked a lot about how working with local governments and supporting their efforts to implement their local climate action plans is a big priority for the Air District. And staff is fully engaged in many activities, working on new model ordinances, new guidance and tools, and developing our climate protection grant program. And one other thing I wanted to mention, in several of the control measures in our plan, when we talk about supporting local government efforts, we also talk about helping local governments secure external funding, maybe not from the Air District, but from other agencies to help implement their plans. And very recently, the state's Natural Resource Agency awarded over $8 million in urban greening grants to East Oakland and Richmond, and the Air District was a very active partner in those applications. So we think that that's a very appropriate role for the Air District as well. So again, returning to that biggest sector of emissions in our inventory, transportation, we're doing a lot to try to support local efforts to focus land use changes and transportation policies on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We're working on new CEQA thresholds and guidelines. We're working on new guidelines for local governments on how to develop robust climate action plans. We're already beginning to work with MTC on the next Plan Bay Area. And then, of course, we have our Planning Healthy Places and our community health risk assessments guidance documents that can help ensure that development is done in the most health protective way possible. So our science and research programs are very critical to implementing many of these things I've just mentioned. We have our emissions inventory work, our greenhouse gas measurement program, our air modeling and air monitoring efforts, and these all are critical to informing our rulemaking, how we move forward with our community air risk evaluation program, all of our climate and clean air policies and programs, helping us target our grant and incentive investments, and thinking about how we design our outreach and communication strategies. And speaking of outreach and communication strategies, our communications team uses a very big suite of tools to help create the widespread buy-in and support that we need for the vision that's in our Clean Air Plan, and to help our community engagement programs engage with the stakeholder community to help implement the right kinds of policies that are going to help us achieve our long-term climate and clean air goals. So while AB 398 does limit our authority to regulate carbon dioxide emissions from large stationary sources, it leaves plenty of regulatory activity on the table to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, as well as our whole suite of non-regulatory tools. In the near term, staff is actively working on rulemaking, including our basin-wide methane strategy. We're absolutely following and participating in opportunities to understand and influence the development of the cap and trade program. We will soon be releasing draft guidance by the end of the year for our climate protection grant program. We're moving forward with all of our other grant programs. As I said, we're developing CEQA thresholds. launching some new activities out of our technology implementation office, and continuing to work with local governments on developing model ordinances and best practices. So we're very active today working on all these fronts, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you.
You're lining up?
Just started the
morning? Yep.
Yeah, okay.
The best side, go ahead.
Abby, thanks so much, and thank you again for all your help and appearing at a lot of events in Marin and sharing your knowledge in the Air District's work with regards to climate and GHG reductions and climate action plans. A question. So though 398 has taken, really shifts so much of the regulation around CO2 for those large sources to the state, and to be covered by cap and trade, don't we have rules in place that are currently monitoring, measuring emissions from those large sources, from those large stationary sources, both as a facility on a facility basis, and then also what's our what was the rule or the program we put in place that's measuring basically emissions sort of associated, I forget the terminology, sort of the footprint of that product, and then also the crude slate that's coming in, we were going to be assessing that. I mean, so what are those rules or those programs still in place? And maybe I'm mischaracterizing them, but I think you know what I'm talking about.
Sure. So, Director Rice, my guess is that you're referring to Rule 1215, which was specifically a emissions tracking rule for the 5 refineries in the Bay Area, and getting emission information but much more consistently, including about information about crude slate as well as the emissions, and requiring fence line monitoring at those facilities. So that is underway. There is a lawsuit about it, but there is compliance that is happening, and it's really important to get that information over time to see the patterns in terms of the emissions and in terms of the qualities, characteristics of the crude slate that come in. So we will continue to track through that rule.
So yes. Assume that stays on track and doesn't get completely sidelined. That information in itself we have control over and can share and can make loud noise about. And I think that there is some leverage with having that information, and I would suspect that we're probably the entity closest to those, to that data that the state should be interested in as well. But I want to make that point that while we might not be able to regulate, we have power with information. Mm-hmm. That's my only comment right now.
Good point. Oh, jumping right out there. Can you go back to slide 2, and I'll ask a question that has very little to do with slide 2. You made a statement, and I really need to clarify this, and I'll do it with two questions. Is black carbon a greenhouse gas, one? And two, is black carbon a greenhouse gas under AB 32?
So black carbon is a greenhouse gas, but it is not included in the Kyoto Protocol greenhouse gases. We call them the Kyoto 6, which are primarily carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and the
fluorinated gas,
exactly.
SF6.
Right. But there are many other greenhouse gases that exist that don't fall under those.
Okay, Abby, let me, and I'll cut it short because the real direction I'm going, I'm looking at these two. Yesterday, we took a huge step with 1118. And in my mind, we went from climate change to health. And Jack made a statement that I hope we really follow up on. You may want to go back and, because I'm probably paraphrasing it, we want to look at black carbon, or PM, at the refineries, not just the normal stuff, but some of the whatever. And when we're working through where 1118 is going to go, I hope we put a lot of leverage and a lot of hammer on how much cleanup you're doing on this really health-related problem. I mean, we have a statement out in a booklet from 2 or 3 years ago, the number one cause of health effects in the air, and the number two, it isn't in the statement, number two cause of climate change. So, I mean, I have a problem when we start lumping, and we do it throughout this discussion here, black carbon into the greenhouse gases. because the last decision for cap and trade may have said CO2, but as we all read through AB 32, it's greenhouse gases. And if we want to continue down a war that's going to get us nowhere, we'll do it. The second thing is, you talked about getting help to cities or counties about, I forget what it is, the hydro, or their clean air plants and stuff. I would suggest actually going to some of the CMAs too. I went through a discussion last night and they were talking about limits of $150,000 for cost benefit analysis. And I go, are any of these areas in a care area or episodic? Oh, it doesn't matter there. And I just shut up and figured I'd come to you first because I didn't want to look that stupid, but I already do. The other thing is you're talking about something about helping with CEQA. I would ask that you really take a hard look at the advanced mitigation program and see if you could do something with that, because that's really where I'm finding the delay. You can get through CEQA, and then you've got to go for years of arguing with whoever wants a piece of the pie. And I thought it was a darn good program when we were going with it. But anyway, that's my 3 points. I'll wait for the next time.
Didn't we once publish or show a slide or something that said that the largest amount of greenhouse gases is produced within the suburbs?
I think you might be recalling the consumption-based emissions inventory, looking at greenhouse gases, not where they're produced, but where the products and services are consumed.
Yeah. Okay. I think that might be. And so then, and now we have our solar ordinance done and the toolkit's out, and that's great work. But we don't. The reason we can't, as a regulatory agency, mandate that new home constructions be built with solar panels is because we don't have authority over building codes, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I'm trying to use my brain here and recall.
And it's working well.
Well, it's a three-hour drive in at, you know, somewhere around 15 miles an hour, so 10. Yeah, you know, so... and then I have to be back here this afternoon. So I'm really looking forward to that. But so my question is, why don't we try to seek legislation in this next legislative year that actually asks that, or mandates that, all new home construction in the state be built with solar? Why don't we try to be bold in that regard? Now that the toolkit's done, now that the ordinance is done, why don't we find somebody to run that? And we know there's going to be the detractors, and we know that everybody's going to want their exemptions. But I mean, we've done some pretty cool things here recently when people said we couldn't get it done. Why don't we do a bill? Why don't we get? And I'm not asking that we get regulatory authority over that, but why don't we have the legislature say, if you're going to build a new home in the state of California, you're going to build it with solar?
I think it's a great idea. We'll take that back. We're about to go through a process where we ask ourselves what's going to be our legislative initiatives for next year, so we'll include that.
Okay. Thank you.
I wanted to respond to your slide, working with local governments, particularly the community choice programs, slide 10. And I mentioned this before, but I thought I'd get a little more quantified. So the agency that I'm a board member for is Silicon Valley Clean Energy. Milpitas has recently joined us. It looks like our surplus, that is, with the policy of carbon-free electricity and being 1% under PG&E's rates, which is where the board... what the board established and we're implementing, we're going to have on the order of $45 million. This is, Milpitas has just elected to join, roughly $45 million of surplus in this current fiscal year, of which we'll probably put at least half of that into rate stabilization reserves, but that may leave substantial money for programs. We have a great industrial base. Not all the CCEs are so lucky, but
I'll just mention this because we're setting up a program advisory committee of citizens from our various cities. And so it'll be 12 cities with Milpitas. And that's actually a lot of money. And we could actually really use the advice, the expert advice of this air district that has refined and honed its, you know, programming to make effective, really effective grants and come up with things that are, I mean, the other thing is, right, we want to be complementary to the air district in the programming that we do rather than duplicative. I mean, we ought to be doing things that make sense together, right? So what I would say is, in addition to strategies and technical assistance to get to zero carbon electricity, to the extent that we now are creating revenue streams for programs, we could really, I think, use the sage advice and vast experience of this air district to help us with those things. I'd love to have, you know, our grants folks come and talk to our advisory committee about what they think would be appropriate in the new year. So thank you.
If I can jump back in, I think Member Haggerty has really touched on something here. And it has to be more than just housing, he said, to each home. Because with the priority development area and stuff we're doing, you're not going to build a lot of homes over the next 20, 25 years. But there will be units that have, you know, if they're smaller units, they'll have a, you know, HOA thing in the middle or whatever. But on top of that, you might be able to, you're more than likely going to be part of a CCA. See if there's somewhere else you can put it. I mean, not to be obstructive here, but if I lived in Ross, I wouldn't be excited about trying to put solar up when, you know, I wouldn't be excited about it there. But the reality is,
you'd be surrounded by redwood trees. Yeah. It wouldn't be effective.
Cut them down. No, the point is that there's a lot of opportunity out there, especially as we start getting into solar. I think this is something that you start our technology implementation officer on and see where it goes and try and work out some legislation where you're not stuck with something that can't work, like trying to cut down the redwoods. But, you know, there are alternatives, a cap and trade of solar, so to speak.
Okay, well, lots of good discussion on that. So thank you very much for the update. We appreciate that.
Can I just add one more thing that I forgot?
Absolutely.
So, and this is breaking news. This is going to hit our board next week. But we went out on an RFP with Monterey Bay for solar plus storage. We had to have at least 4 hours. This is to get us over the duck curve. And wind. And the bids that came in, we had about 90 of them. We're probably going to settle on four of them. The average wholesale price of solar plus 4 hours of storage and wind is coming in at about 3.5 cents wholesale. So I've heard a lot of people talk about 12 cents and 5 cents and 4 cents solar at 3 cents, but this is solar plus storage. So if anybody thinks that, you know, the time isn't ripe for us to be getting very aggressive about going for a carbon-free electricity, think again. Thanks.
Any other jumpers? No. Okay.
Jumpers.
Oh, you just jumped in again.
Sorry.
Okay. So thank you. Thank you for that. Okay. So if we can go back up.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes.
We do have public comments on this item.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm sorry. Yes, go ahead.
Sarah Greenwald, Janet Stromberg, and Jed Holtzman.
Hi, my name's Sarah Greenwald, representing 350 San Francisco. I'm going to be super quick because we haven't got a quorum, and I know you guys are, all of you are very aware that we're in an emergency situation, and you're probably feeling kind of hopeless because in some ways your feet have been cut out from under you. And So I'm really pleased that the kind of determination I'm seeing to move forward, that's what you need. That's a great thing. And I would not abandon the refinery end of things, however, because that's, you know, as you pointed out, the carbon black problem and the PM2.5s, that's killing people now. 2,000 to 3,000 in the Bay Area. Okay, so that cannot be abandoned. I would simply remind you of that fact and turn it over to my colleague.
Janet Stromberg, 350 Bay Area. I wonder if we could go back to slide 3, please. Abby's talk covered so many topics. I don't think I can finish in 3 minutes, but we'll see how far I get. Looking at the language in the italics, prevents air, 398 prevents air districts from adopting or implementing an emissions reduction rule for CO2 from sources subject to the cap and trade program. With all due respect, I find that staff here are continually equating emissions reduction rule with control strategies, rules that control emissions, regulate emissions. That's not what the rules, what AB 398 says, and we are still waiting to have a conversation where the difference of opinion about what exactly the air district is restricted from doing is openly talked about, because our attorney has a completely different interpretation of this. Unfortunately, he broke his leg, so he's not here today. Moving on to slide 4, I think it would be really helpful to go back to a pie chart that shows all of the greenhouse gas emissions in the Bay Area, because it's a little bit skewed to just look at 95% of stationary sources, because the Air District has authority over everything pretty much except for emissions from emissions from vehicular sources. And these other sources are often called area sources. And the area sources is where you have a lot of overlap with cities and counties in terms of your ability to regulate. They can regulate some aspects of things, and you can regulate other aspects of things. And consciously looking at the area source emissions would allow you to work more obviously, so the public could observe that, in making a strategy for getting to those emissions. And a lot of those issues boil down to the problem of fuel switching from natural gas to electricity. And there are statutory issues and regulatory issues at the state level that are inhibiting that, that don't allow incentives to be able to be given to switch from gas to electricity. And so as you're looking for legislation, I urge you to perhaps explore that. We in the grassroots are trying to get a handle on it, and it's so complicated, I haven't yet gotten my mind around it, but I'm hoping to get my mind around it someday and come up with like 3 bullet points where it can be explained and generate some interest and action on that. And I have a lot more other comments, but I will just quickly say that we hope that the Air District will, when it adopts the permit rule requirements that EPA is demanding, that we'll keep the permit rule open, because we think there is a lot of opportunity for regulating greenhouse gases regardless of AB 398. And we feel that we have not been able to have that conversation. And so we're urging you on December 6th, which I believe is a rule adoption hearing for the permit rules, that someone encourages staff to keep working on that and to hold some kind of a public forum so we can get the ideas on the table and start working them out and see if there are directions we can go with those. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Chair Barrett and Directors Jed Holtzman, 350 Bay Area. Could we go back to slide 3 again? If we could go back to slide 3. Oh, thanks. So again, the actual language on the slide was not what was said to you, and so I think it's really important that we be careful with our language, especially when we're talking about the law, which is expressly based on words. A pie chart has been presented to you before that kind of shows you how greenhouse gases are distributed in the region based on the gas, and We don't have that graph in this presentation, but I recall that CO2, which was like the blackish gray, really dirty colored piece, was, I want to say, about 85% of the GHGs in the region. So to the extent that 80 to 85% of the GHGs in the region are CO2, and to the extent that 95% of that is now out of your purview, I think that we should not sugarcoat. I appreciate the positive attitude from the presentation, but we should not sugarcoat the fact that if you were to look at the full amount of GHGs in the region and you were to have another pie chart that showed the amount that you can still touch, it's a very small part of that pie chart now. And given the huge emissions reductions that we need and all of the things that we've said that we want to do in the Clean Air Plan, I don't think that we should sugarcoat that in any way, shape, or form. To the extent that we now need to become focused on model ordinances and best practices and stuff like that, that should worry us, because if you actually read the plan, you'll find that a lot of the substantive reductions were not necessarily predicted to come from those measures, although they're very important, and of course we need to be firing on all cylinders. On slide number 5, it was presented that only 5 measures are touched by this restriction, but the basin-wide combustion strategy was presented to us as basically the main way that the Air District was going to decarbonize the region. So just throwing that up there as a measure that out of 5, I mean, that was kind of sold to us as the main thing that was going to carry the weight. Also, AB 398 limits reductions. So if there are no reductions expected, then you are not precluded from initiating and executing that rule. SS 11 is not expected to result in any reductions, so you are not precluded from implementing it. SS 17 is not expected to reduce emissions. It's meant to limit increases of emissions, which is a fundamentally different thing, legally and commonsensically. So you are not precluded from instituting that. Limiting increases is not reducing. Lastly, to your point about black carbon, we really do need to get super aggressive on black carbon, especially now that the legs have been cut out from under us. But 1118 does not really come online till about 2026. We can go after black carbon in much more direct way through much more direct regulation, and we really need to do that for public health and climate protection. I have more to say, but thank you.
Okay, that's it. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you again. Okay, I'm going to take us back up the agenda to item number 3, the approval of the minutes for September 21st. Okay. First and second. And if there's no opposition, they stand as submitted.
Madam Chair.
Yes?
Just for your edification, I just want to mention that for the speakers, we have a meeting planned tomorrow to it's been on the calendar here for some time, but we're going to be going through a number of the comments that they raised to you today about the permitting rule that you're going to be considering on December 6th and as it relates to AB 398 and some of the restrictions we now face. So we are going to have that staff discussion with representatives of 350 Bay Area.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Are there any committee member comments or other business? Yes?
I had one, but I got to get to the page to remember what it is. Did you just jump ahead of one?
5. Okay. I'm sorry. You know what? I skipped number 5. I'm okay. Sorry. Okay.
Let's go back to 5.
Hold on to that one. I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, I just went from 3 to 6. So. Thank you. Air Resources Board Draft 2017 Climate Change Scoping Plan Update.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Staff wanted to give you a brief update on the California Air Resources Board's scoping plan update for addressing greenhouse gases. They are taking an update to their board, I believe, in December. And we just thought it would be helpful to give you a brief overview of what's changed with that scoping plan update, what it covers, and David Birch will give that presentation.
Can you hear me? Okay. So ARB staff has been working to update the statewide climate change scoping plan for the past couple of years now. As you know, the statewide scoping plan serves as the basic roadmap for the state's comprehensive climate protection program. ARB staff issued a draft in January of this year and sought public comment and workshop process, got about 220 written public comments. And then, of course, in the intervening months, the legislature was active and there were some important bills enacted as well. So ARB staff has digested that input and looked at the legislation, issued a revised version of the update scoping plan in late October, and that's what they intend to take to their board in December. The update follows the same basic template that was already developed for purposes of the initial scoping plan adopted in 2008, as well as the 2014 update. But the new update does respond to the recent direction from the legislature. One of the messages that the legislature certainly wanted to deliver was that they wanted to ensure that the benefits of the scoping plan program and actions would accrue equitably to communities and income groups all across the state. So ARB outlined some key objectives for the 2017 update. Most importantly, they wanted to provide a strategy to achieve the 2030 GHG reduction target. That's the same target we have in our climate protection plan to reduce emissions 40% below 1990 by 2030, and also then to look further down the road and set them on a pathway to achieve the more ambitious target of 80% reductions by year 2050. They wanted to ensure that the plan would maximize reductions in air quality, the co-benefits there, the ozone, the PM, black carbon we've already talked about, in order to protect public health, especially in the communities that are most impacted. They wanted to make sure that the strategy would provide flexibility for regulated sources so that they could comply with the emission reductions in the most cost-effective manner possible. They, of course, were concerned, as they have been all along, with minimizing leakage so that we don't just end up transferring GHG-producing activities outside of the California through our efforts here in the state. They wanted to make sure that investments generated from the cap-and-trade program revenues would be equitably distributed, especially with the focus in disadvantaged communities. And they wanted to make sure that the program here in California would be designed so that it would facilitate collaboration with national and subnational programs beyond California. With those objectives in mind, ARB staff is ultimately recommending a proposed scenario that's a combination of statutorily required programs which have already been adopted in combination with the extension of the cap and trade program beyond 2020. ARB staff did, however, consider several alternatives as they were developing the plan. Those plans were sort of a combination of different emphases on whether it would be a market-based program versus command and control. So one of the alternatives considered was basically no cap-and-trade program at all and complete reliance on a prescriptive command and control approach. They also looked at a carbon tax, which would provide a way to use the market to reduce GHG emissions, but it does not actually set any specific numerical cap. And then they also looked at what they called cap and tax, where they would put a declining cap on individual facilities and tax the emissions from those facilities, but there would be no trading allowed among facilities. Ultimately, the staff is recommending that the program continue on the pathway with the combination of required programs and cap and trade as being the best fit for those objectives that they outlined in terms of being able to ensure that they achieve GHG reductions, offering linkage to other programs, flexibility to regulated sources, and generating revenues for the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. So there's a lot of pieces, of course, to the scoping plan, but the key elements are outlined here. So pursuant to the short-lived climate protection plan that ARB adopted last year, a key element of the strategy will be to achieve major reductions in emissions of those short-lived climate pollutants that have high global warming potential between now and 2030. So we're talking about methane, black carbon, and the fluorinated gases. Another key element is to continue reducing the carbon intensity of fuels by ratcheting up the low carbon fuel standard from the current 10% to 18% beyond 2020. Pursuant to SB 350 in the energy sector, the plan is looking at an increase in renewable electricity up to 50% of the portfolio by 2030, as well as a doubling of energy efficiency savings in existing buildings in that by that 2030 timeframe as well. Transportation, of course, is a key sector, and so the strategy is looking at both achieving reductions from motor vehicle technologies, from the low carbon fuel standard, and also looking at reductions in motor vehicle travel. The staff draft is calling for overall reductions on an aggregate basis of about 15% in VMT in order to achieve the long-range goals. And that's not just per capita, that's VMT, a 15% reduction in VMT, even including the fact that population will continue to increase in the state. And of course, the other key piece here being the continued implementation of the cap and trade program beyond 2020, now that it's been reauthorized. One key difference between the new draft that was just issued versus the draft that they put out in January is that the January draft had contained a proposal where ARB would pursue direct rulemaking to reduce emissions from the oil refineries by 20% by the year 2030. However, pursuant to AB 398, which Abby talked about, that legislation specifically says that for purposes of controlling CO2 emissions from oil refineries and from natural oil and gas production, that the cap and trade program will serve as the rule. So in response to that provision of AB 398, they have deleted the proposal for a specific 20% regulation. This slide here is taken from the plan, and it shows the expected emission reductions on a cumulative basis between year 2021 and 2030. So that's sort of the key coming decade. ARB staff estimates that overall the cumulative reduction in greenhouse gases that will be needed during that 10-year period will be about 620 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent. As you see here, the two big hitters are the cap and trade program at about 38% of the total reductions, as well as the reductions in those short-lived climate pollutants, what we call super GHGs in our plan. We're talking about the methane, black carbon, and fluorinated gases. So collectively, those two elements are anticipated to account for over 70% of the total reductions in that 2021 to 2030 period. As a complement to the update to the scoping plan, ARB has also been working on looking at revisiting the VMT reduction targets for the different metro areas in the state pursuant to SB 375. These reductions, of course, are predicated on the idea of a per capita reduction in VMT, not absolute reduction. And this has been you know, there's been negotiations, conversations back and forth between the MPOs in the different metro areas and ARB staff about what is really viable here. The current recommendations that you see for the big four metro areas there are pretty similar, but basically for the Bay Area, they're proposing an increase the target for the year 2035 from a current target of 15% reduction in per capita VMT to 19% going forward. It's important to point out, though, that ARB specifically says in the scoping plan that that reduction from these SB 375 targets will not be enough in and of itself, that there is going to need to be greater reductions in per capita VMT on the order of 25% statewide in order to achieve the long-range targets. And in order to do that, then, in addition to each of the metro areas implementing their sustainable community strategy successfully, there's going to be need to be additional efforts on the part of ARB working with the metro areas and local governments to get other ways of reducing vehicle travel that's not directly captured in these sustainable community strategies. In terms of the nexus to between the statewide scoping plan update and our clean air plan that you all just adopted in April, we, of course, were following the SB 375 update process as we developed our plan. The whole idea here is that these plans should be complementary. And at the large scale, there's a lot of similarity in the plans. The main strategy that drives both plans is the combination of a short-term focus on taking advantage of the opportunity to reduce emissions of these super GHGs to the greatest extent possible in the near term, while we lay the groundwork for the longer-term, more comprehensive effort to reduce CO2 emissions and decrease fossil fuel combustion from all of the key sectors, transportation, buildings, energy, et cetera. Abby talked a lot about how we're going to go about doing that, so I'm not going to reiterate it here, but we are pursuing a suite of rulemaking to reduce emissions, methane emissions from the key sectors, and we have our grant programs, et cetera. One of our key aspects of our overall effort, of course, is our collaboration with local agencies to help support their local climate protection efforts. The scoping plan very clearly recognizes that local governments are essential partners in implementation of the statewide plan, and that takes the form both of using their very broad powers and local authority to address emissions from a lot of the key sectors, transportation, buildings, et cetera. So the state, the local actions can help to make sure that the statewide measures are achieved in their areas, but local governments can also go beyond what's in the scoping plan to try to achieve additional emission reductions in their areas and to serve as test beds for innovative policies and programs that may be proved to be something that can be replicated in other areas. Another key role that the local governments can play and that ARB recognizes is that local governments can engage and educate their residents about how their day-to-day activities contribute to GHG emissions and effective actions that they can take. And, of course, we've tried to support that by developing the consumption-based inventory that we provided to the local agencies. So we'll continue our efforts to support and enhance the local climate protection programs. Going forward then, the ARB board is scheduled to consider the scoping plan update at their meeting in December 14th, 15th. ARB staff will also be very busy in the next few years making adjustments to the guidelines for the cap and trade program to reflect the direction that was provided in AB 398. And we'll continue to be busy here in moving forward with the implementation of our clean air plan, pursuing those new methane rules, and developing our long-term CO2 reduction strategies, all with the idea of making sure that we are on that pathway to achieve the transformative vision that we outlined for year 2050 in our 2017 plan. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Is there public comment on this?
I have Janet Stromberg, Jed Holtzman, and Gary Hughes.
Okay.
Hello again. There's a real danger of getting lost in the details and missing what's going on right now. 15,000 scientists just signed a letter to humanity urging us that we need to be urgent about this. And I think it's very clear to me, having followed the AB 398 process from the beginning when WISPA put a proposal on Jerry Brown's table, that whole cap-and-trade rule is so flawed, it is not going to achieve what they are claiming it's going to be. And we need to just think, how do we move forward and let the state do what it's doing? They're on the wrong track with that. They're not going to reduce emissions from these large sources. They don't have the courage to set the allocations or the carbon price properly. So we need to go back and look at 1216, and we need to go back and look at the authority that the Air District has to regulate the co-pollutants. Specifically, we really have to focus on particulate matter. We all know that that's the number one health problem. We all know that the refineries are the largest sources, except for the Lehigh. And so why can't we cap those emissions? Why can't we put 1216 right back on the table and cap those emissions? And the reason is we have loopholes in the permitting rules. And I think the reason staff held back from that and came back and said, okay, let's forget about the criteria pollutants, let's just look at GHGs, is because of the existing permits to pollute that are equivalent to a whole nother refinery. Well, somewhere we have to get our moles all together and whack them all at the same time. And we have to take away those permits to pollute. That's what we have to do. And you have to figure out, are you going to do it on a holistic way? Change the permit program to stop the loopholes that allow these permits to be based on potential emissions instead of actual emission increases. And go back and put that cap on there. You have the authority to do that. You have the authority to adopt regulations that take away permitted emissions. That happens all the time when you say you now need to put in a new boiler. You had a permit that said you could emit this amount of NOx from your old boiler. You can't do that anymore. So the urgency of the climate program, I wish that I could hear more decibels in this room about how devastating it is. And if we can get somewhere by limiting co-pollutants, by reducing co-pollutants, because the best way to reduce combustion is to reduce PM, you will get somewhere. And here it's very frustrating to listen to endless talking, and we're not just fighting it. So thank you.
Thank you again, Chair Barrett and directors. We just had a really two fierce presentations about the fires, and Director Zane called in from Sonoma and gave this like very emotional, we all had this moving moment together, and how quickly it's already fading, because this really represents like the symphony playing, you know, on the deck of the Titanic while it is actually sinking. This is actually very stressful. Neither of us planned to speak on this item. If ARB is now solely responsible for basically saving us all from the climate crisis, which AB 398 is telling us and which your staff is telling us, even going beyond the letter of the law, and this scoping plan is the way that ARB is going to do that, I think it's incredibly critical that you be very informed on this plan, that you watchdog this plan, because this is instead of you doing the things that you're supposed to do. This is instead of you doing your job. And as a climate advocate, I would say that this is falling radically short, and radically short of the vision that the Air District put out for 2050 in the Clean Air Plan. Ultimately, there are some similarities along the near and short term the short and long term focuses, but you know, the vision for the region, which the Clean Air Plan presented, is not a nice to have. Like, that is literally necessary for the persistence of our way of life. And so the idea that we can then look at, oh, well, instead, let's look at chipping around the edges. Also, we see here that the plan turns around and leans on local governments to take actions. You all know that most local governments don't even have the capacity to run their own community choice program, much less to do innovative, world-changing greenhouse gas reduction measures. I go to boards, commissions, and agencies at the local, regional, and occasionally state level, and what I see is people turning around and looking at each other serially, all thinking that each other are going to fill in the gaps that they all see in their data. Like, oh, we're only getting 20% of the way there, but they will all fix it over there. Then they're over here thinking the same thing, and they're over here thinking the same thing. This is not going to get us there. Taking a holistic vision like your staff did is what is actually necessary to, like, iron down the rug and make sure there aren't any spots that are sticking up. This strategy calls for 40% reductions compared to a 2013 baseline, not even the 1990 baseline that the goals actually are meant to reach. The 20% reduction of emissions from refineries was originally proposed instead of the caps, and now that was also taken away. The oil industry ran the table here. A California Democratic Party analysis shows paragraphs from oil lobbyist presentations are in the final law. We cannot allow this to take away our authority. Thank you very much.
All right. My name is Gary Hughes. I work with Friends of the Earth, and this is the first time I've had an opportunity to be here before the committee. Our organization has many years of involvement before the Air Resources Board regarding different climate policy, including cap and trade and the scoping plan. I try to share a couple of thoughts here really quick. I think it's really important, as has been stated, that this committee and the board really track the scoping plan very closely, the performance of the scoping plan. So one point I want to point out, for instance, is there's a lot of assumptions about how California is reducing emissions. To point out, though, that the difference in emissions reductions between 2014 in 2015 is totally canceled out by the Aliso Canyon event. And then as far as the ARB manages the emissions inventory, the Aliso County event is mentioned on the inventory, but it's stated that, well, we'll compensate for this at some point in the future. But the reality for the atmosphere, of course, is that California is not reducing its emissions because of our reliance on this type of industry. You know, the cap and trade program, it's really interesting. Even ARB staff are referring now to the magic of the market, is everyone's hoping, you know, that somehow this free market, the invisible hand, is going to come in and work the trick. But we now have information because of the data that was released for the mandatory reporting regulation. If you take a really close look at the 2016 data, all of the facilities that are managed by cap and trade, that the electricity sector is responsible for the reductions, and that actually the refinery sector emissions have gone up. So that's what we're confronting. So there's a lot of dangers with pollution trading. There's a lot of dangers in relying on the market mechanism. And one of the other items, then, just to share an insight, something to track with the scoping plan, for instance, the natural and working lands element, they're aspiring to reduce up to a total of 15 to 20 million metric tons by 2030. But the California Natural Resources Agency and the Air Resources Board actually did not have an answer when I brought up, well, you're facing an issue of double counting, because if you're using forest offsets in the cap and trade program, but then going to try to include those carbon emission reductions or emissions avoidance, you're double counting. So the a whole manner by which California goes forward measuring emissions reductions in the scoping plan is really subject to a lot of dangers of double counting. So this is something that the board really has to watch out for, because we're really at tremendous risk of not meeting our 2030 emissions reduction goal. And the last thing I'll say here, I'll probably go over in just a moment, is everyone's probably noticed that Lisa Murkowski, senator from Alaska, has introduced legislation to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling. Well, we know, all of us who have watched the fossil fuel industry in California, that one of the primary refining areas for oil coming out of Alaska is California. So our organization is going to do the very best we can to ensure that anytime anyone talks about ANWR, that they talk about the refinery sector here in California, because they are connected intimately. And it's the responsibility of this board and the committee here to ensure that we're committing ourselves to protecting our climate and to allow Arctic National Wildlife Refuge oil to come into California for refining would be one of those tremendous ironies that I'm sure we would all have a hard time telling our grandchildren about. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any comments on from the board? Well, I'm just going to say two things that caught my ear in this presentation and actually were stated by at least one of the speakers. You know, in our town, we can't even figure out, we can't get the Army Corps of Engineers to dredge our river, which is silting up and threatening to undo the progress of a $43 million flood fix because of the silt behind it. And, you know, we don't have the money in our town to do a lot of things. So when we're talking about, as a district, that we're ready to partner with municipalities and other local governments, I just keep thinking, gee, are we the only poor kid on the block? Or, it's not going to happen in my area. You know, I just don't see that happening unless money comes with it. So I'm not sure how viable that is as a enforcement goal. And the other thing, I guess, is a question I had in reading this and listening to the presentation. On slide 5, the key elements of the revised strategy, you know, are we confident that CARB is going to go forward in reducing carbon dioxide emissions in California? Because that really has been taken off our plate and put on theirs, and we really can't do anything about that. So, where are we on? I mean, what is our role here?
So I do think that we expect that California will be a key player in the climate world. I certainly understand the urgency of the stakeholders. I share that myself. I do think CARB is committed to this, and other state agencies are committed to focusing on reducing greenhouse gases in the state and setting example for the nation. But I also agree that it's important for this board to keep track of what's going on. I think that's an important thing for us to do. So these kinds of reports and strategies that the state's implementing, and when we can find out what kind of reductions they're getting, we'll bring it to this committee to keep you up to date.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ron.
Thank you. A question on slide 5, the 375 targets. These are our targets on which baseline of which year?
For 2020.
Sorry. Thank you.
The numbers on this slide apply for year 2035.
Which baseline year? So 15% or 19% reduction from
it's 2020. I believe it was based on the original targets were based on year 2013.
I mean, a lot of these things, including our own chart, right, are based on trending since what we assume 1990 was, I guess, right?
So right. The SB 375 targets had a more recent baseline,
okay.
Not 1990.
That's helpful to know. So it seems like, am I correct in thinking that the folks on CARB, the CARB staff, serve at the pleasure of the governor? So the head of CARB and everybody else there is basically aligning with the governor's program and the grand bargain and cap and trade?
There's the members of the CARB board get vetted through the Senate, I think.
They do. Okay.
Yeah, so
the board
members.
But they're
the staff are,
they're nominated by the governor, is that correct?
I think, yes. Yeah, then you there's more recently there's some that
so
Senate and pro tem.
I guess
and
I mean
speaker.
I guess the point I'm making is if the governor decided earlier this year that cap and trade was his legacy and the best thing he could do, I mean, it's no great surprise that CARB's primary strategy and what they're suggesting to do in December is based on cap and trade. So I get that. I guess my comment would be, you know, a year from now, we will have elected a new governor, right? And that new governor might have a different view of the world. So I share the view that we ought to stay on top of what they're doing, and right, we ought to look and see how, the extent we can, we ought to keep measuring and seeing how effective cap and trade is, and nothing would preclude us a year from now from lobbying the incoming governor to say, you know, we need to do something different here. This is not enough, and you know, you need to bring some other tools to the table. I'm frankly disappointed that you know, there doesn't seem to be enough political will in Sacramento to have a carbon tax, because I think that would be a straightforward way. If you valued carbon at 40 or whatever it is per metric ton, 40 bucks, you could really move it. And I'm told, right, that with SB1 we just can't keep taxing carbon more. But I think as time goes on and we see that we're not moving the needle fast enough, we have every reason to stay on top of this as a Bay Area and then go lobby for what we think ought to be statewide policy, especially with a new woman or man in the governor's office. Thank you.
Yes.
While we're on 7, just to look at this, the SB 375 Steinberg is part of the scoping plan to reduce 32% of the greenhouse gases to the 1990 levels by 2020. Then the second half down here, ARB is proposing to revise those greenhouse gases to the 2035 levels from that 2020 level. I don't know when they did it, but this is how we're supposed to try and get down to the main goal of 80% below that 1990 level by 2050. So it's supposed to be just a stepping stone, I believe, to us getting to the real biggie, which is 80% below. Just while we're on that, if I'm wrong, go back to it, but let me get to my points and get the heck off to somebody else. I think it's just the classic governmental statement when it says minimize potential leakage, and we got a cap and trade program that lets you spend 50% of the money outside the state. Anyway, the other thing is we talk about the 80% reduction. That doesn't include PM. That's that 80% reduction I just brought up with SB 375 is the major component of AB 32. Would love to get a copy of the latest climate action plan or whatever they're doing. I think I asked Richard Corey for it to begin with. I hope you didn't send it to me and I chucked it in a drawer or something. But more importantly, I'd like to get the reforestation protocol, which I never hear anybody talk about. The oddity is the scoping plan tells you how to reduce the emissions, but it's the reforestation protocol that is taking it out of the air. Nobody cares about it. I mean, it's odd to me. We had two things brought up in the discussion just to let you know we are paying attention. One about the pie chart, and it talked about 85% of it's the dark area, carbon dioxide. I think that's a nice thing to see on the chart. And then right next to it, okay, what is the effective? Since methane's 24 or 50, I see so many different numbers, more deleterious. And you get into the hydrofluorocarbons, which is what I thought we started to talk about today, which are 10,000 times worse. And I'd also like to find out sulfur hexafluoride is one of those fluorocarbons. It sort of gets caught in the middle. But, I mean, what are we effectively talking about? If we do something that's 1% of the problem, but it's 10,000 times worse and out there for 100 years instead of, or 10,000 years instead of 15 days, then, you know, we might want to know that too. The report card, it keeps coming up. It may be as simple as every quarter we show what we've done for the reductions since 1990 down to what we saw at 1118. It's benzene's this much, particulate matter was a nice little blue part of the bar. I'm hearing how bad we're doing, and I'm looking at charts and saying, you know, we're doing pretty good. So maybe it's time just in the report card, I ask for it every 6 months, but at least start now. If it's no more than just that chart again, hey, you know, this is what we've done so far, guys. We're trying to get this little thing down here reduced, of which half is particulate matter or black carbon, whatever we're going to call it tomorrow. But and then build off of it from that, because people keep asking for it. We keep showing it to them, and it gets blown off in a staff report as if we've never shown it to them. It was there yesterday. What we asked for was today was in the report yesterday.
Okay. Did you want to say something?
Yeah.
Of course.
A question, and I think this week is catching up on me because that this slide is, I'm not sure I'm understanding it. So the targets, the ARB's targets for the ARB, the Bay Area targets are being revised on the GHG reductions from 15 to 19. Is that of our total GHG emissions for the region? Or is that related to a subset?
It's a little confusing the way it's expressed. It's based on GHG emissions from light-duty motor vehicles.
Okay.
But it's often expressed in terms of VMT, the vehicle travel. But technically, it's related to more specifically to the GHG reductions from light duty vehicles.
Yeah.
Which we don't have any regulatory authority over.
Not directly.
So this is the pointing the finger of who's supposed to take care of what, and hope that they do part. The crossing our fingers part. Okay. And then I get on board with everybody around our need to be, I think, frankly, being very present and hounding and using the information we have about the emissions we don't control, but we're relying on CARB to control and cap and trade to control, and to be just dogging that board and those board members so that we're actually being very blatant about what's not happening and or what is, and then also hold ourselves accountable as well for where we can actually have impact.
Yeah, and I said I was going to let this go, but I cannot let it go. When you talk about funneling this down to the cities, 100 cities, 9 counties, or 101, 8 counties plus, however you want to put it, I'm just going to deal with my city. We have at least 50 electric charging units around town, which we went after from day one. I think we were the first general plan that was approved once we started doing the climate scoping plan. I hope by the end of the year to have an autonomous vehicle on the streets. We've submitted to DMV for our licenses. But more importantly, it's the mindset of the people in the city. We just hired a city manager less than a year ago. His one request was to get rid of his car allowance and get him a hydrogen car, and we've opened a hydrogen refueling, which I'd like to see more of, because I think it is also coming. This is not something where people are just missing the boat completely. They are moving forward as expeditiously as you can, but you only have so much money, you only have so much time, and there are other problems out there besides greenhouse gases, or at least the 6 that we're dealing with AB 32.
Okay, thank you very much. Now I think I can ask for committee member comments and other business. None?
I do have
one. You do have one.
It just came up last night, and it really concerns me. We had we flew in our rep from Washington, D.C., and apparently commuter benefits is really under attack, and the legislation's going out there. Since we sponsored the bill, that we just had Glazer go back through from the pilot program. I think it would be nice to let Ledge know how this might affect our program. If the employers are going to lose 50% of their benefit from commuter benefits, they might not be as excited about doing it as at least our business park is.
Okay, anyone else? Okay, so that's the end of this meeting, and we are adjourning until the next meeting will be as needed. Thank you.